Hi, this is Lauren, Associate Editor of Neurology Reviews. With me is Dr. Rex L. Cannon, Director of the Clinical Neuroscience Laboratory at the University of Tennessee and Director of the Cognitive Neuroscience Laboratory at Cole Neuroscience Center Memory Disorder Clinic in Knoxville, Tennessee. At the Alzheimer's Association International Conference 2012, Dr. Cannon presented a study examining neurocognitive evaluations to predict driving ability in patients with Alzheimer's disease. We're going to be discussing that study now. Dr. Cannon, can you give a brief summary of your study and your findings thus far?
Well, the basic impetus of the study is that there has to be some other component that would impair or at least predict a person's ability to drive when they have dementia, because we have a lot of caregivers who worry about their husbands or wives driving. So we decided to get young adults, normal aging, patients with Alzheimer's disease, early Alzheimer's disease, and a group of MCI. So right now it is apparent that at least 89% of the driving patients can't complete the task because we give them maps that they have to commit to memory and then complete the task. So we have two tasks for Alzheimer's patients and three for the normal young and the normal aging. And they can, most of the aging one, normal aging and the young adults can complete the task. However, Alzheimer's disease, right now, it's about 3% can actually complete the task.
Why is it that Alzheimer's participants perform at a level comparable to the younger or similar age drivers on written tests of driving knowledge, but not on overall percentage of participants in a collision?
This would be an artifact of well-learned behavior, well-learned knowledge. I mean, you have this over time. Plus, the Alzheimer's patients are much more attentive to the questions, much more attentive to the answers, and they do take probably 4 minutes longer to complete the task because they examine the questions in great detail. So they certainly pay more attention than the other groups. Maybe it's that it takes more to integrate to find the answer.
At what point should patients' autonomy be curtailed for the benefit of safety?
Well, I think there are two considerations. Number one would be if anosognosia is present. There are some patients who will take the map, look at it for 3 seconds, and say, okay, I got it, and then drive for 15 minutes aimlessly. So I think when they are a danger to themselves or others, that's, I guess, where we should draw a definitive line.
How do we currently determine whether a patient is safe to drive, and what's a clinician's role in this process?
I think for the most part we go by caregiver reports, and there may be some testing involved, but typically they use the TRAILS test like we're using in this study, and some of the patients can actually do fairly well on that compared to other cognitive measures. So I think there needs to be more information for each patient. But typically, we go by caregiver reports and just their overall level of functioning.
What happens if a patient doesn't want to comply with the recommendation to stop driving?
Well, that's a sticky wicket there. I guess the courts can't actually have their keys removed or just ban them from driving. I think that a lot of patients are willing, even though it is quite detrimental to their self-esteem, because we do depend on driving and being autonomous. But usually the keys, the doctor will talk with them and try to encourage them to not drive, but just tell them to keep in mind it is not safe to them or others. Oh, yeah, we always have the legal system, so just to make sure. Sometimes you have to keep them safe despite what they believe.
Do you have any advice for clinicians and family members of patients with Alzheimer's disease?
You know, we want to try to encourage people to have physical movement, to stay engaged with social interactions. And I think when people become less confident, because Alzheimer's patients do, there is a jolt to their self-confidence. And if they they should try to facilitate their movement, their production in society as much as they can, because we know how important exercise and staying active is. But you also have to watch, just observe. And if something doesn't feel right or is counterintuitive, it usually is, and an examination might add more information to that. I mean, they're great patients, they're great people, and they're very endearing. So,
do you have anything else to add on the general topic of, you know, dealing with the sticky question of when a patient should stop driving?
Well, I think accidents or typically, I mean, people may be, as an example, a person may be trying to back out of the driveway, and if anosognosia is present, and of course a loss of integration in the world, may bump into the tree three or four times or bump into the garage trying to pull the car in there and not even realize 10 seconds before they just bumped into the garage door. So, I mean, at some point we do have to draw a line. I just don't know what the line is. We're trying to figure out what cognitive test scores would make the best model for giving a statistically significant result that you should not drive. It would not be safe.
I noticed that you know, you have future evaluations planned for your study. Can you talk briefly about any of those?
We do have an equation. I can say that it's very interesting that verbal fluency measured as an executive function would predict collisions or your inability to complete the task. And that was somewhat surprising to me, but it really makes sense. If you cannot integrate the world with all the information we have, all the use of language, then you'll see just deficits occur in activities of daily living, et cetera, et cetera. So we plan to actually test the model. We may run simulations. We may run other groups just to see. We're going to try to include a mid-range normal adult, say 26 to 55, just to get a feel about would be over the life span. Because what is interesting is that young adults do fairly poor in collisions and monitoring themselves in the car, were not too dissimilar from Alzheimer's disease. So it's not that they have, I mean, it's just executive function. I mean, as you're growing up and you're developing, while your executive functions are developing, you can integrate the world, self-regulate. And it's in reverse in Alzheimer's disease. Because on tested executive functions, they do quite poorly.
That's very interesting. And I noticed that the objective of your study was to determine the most robust neurocognitive evaluations. And I was curious if there was any one that stood out to you, or is it sort of the whole equation, but looking at them all as a group?
I think the equation could be reduced. One of the problems in neurocognitive testing now is redundancy. There's one interesting finding, and I'll put it in the paper when we publish it, is that with 60 seconds, Alzheimer's patients can only produce a limited number of words. However, if you give them 45 seconds extra, they can generate more words. They're just doing it much more slowly. It's almost as if they don't come right away. Or they'll answer it later and give you the words you were seeking. So I think at least the goal would be to take two easily administered neurocognitive exams, say the CST or the MoCA, or anything in that range. It just doesn't matter. Something that captures it without being redundant. And you could, as long as it's measuring verbal fluency and some aspect of inhibition or disinhibition, as well as the trails, or like on the MoCA, they have the cube and the little mini trails test. So it's verbal fluency, visual spatial, and I think that would capture it for the most general part, but you'd have to, I mean, verbal fluency tends to be very important.
Thank you very much for your time, Dr. Cannon.